Hi, this is Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, and welcome to another episode of the Silmarillion Seminar.
Welcome to Silmarillion Seminar 32 and the third and final week of discussion on the Al-Kalabaith. This week we talk about the destruction of Numenor, specifically Iluvatar's epic smiting of the Numenoreans, what of Worth was destroyed in Numenor, the connection between Isildur and the White Tree of Gondor, Lost Mariners, whether Amandil's voyage to Valinor was a success or failure, and the surprise connection between Numenor and other mythical lands. Please enjoy listening to this episode, The Castle of Arg.
Good evening, and welcome back to the Silmarillion Seminar. Tonight we begin our third and final week on the Al-Kalabaith. If you've been listening for a while, you know that I have been in a continual struggle against the participants in the seminar about when this thing is going to end. They are always wanting me to add another week in discussing these things. We shall certainly... They've already stretched the Al-Kalabaith out to a third week. We shall certainly finish it tonight. So, anyway, last week we got through the bad times in Numenor. Our first week's discussion focused primarily on the establishment of Numenor and the decision of the Valar to take the Edain out of Middle-earth leading up to... We got as far as the debate between the representatives of the Valar and the Numenoreans. About the destiny of men and why wanting to be immortal was not a good idea. Then last week we were looking at the decline of Numenor that followed from that all the way up to Ar-Pharazôn and Sauron's participation over there in Numenor. And we were just about up to the breaking of the ban. So I want to start with looking at not the attack of Ar-Pharazôn, but I want to start with Amandil and Elendil. And we didn't talk at all about Isildur and the stealing of the fruit of the tree. So if you guys wanted to talk about that too, we could certainly do that. John, I think you wanted to talk about Amandil? If you're able to get to your mic there, you'd be welcome to start us off there. No, well, I'll try coming back to you then, John. It's no problem. Anyone else want to start us off here? We are actually... somewhat few tonight. We've got a lowish attendance here this evening, though others might perhaps trickle in as we go. Laura?
Yeah, I'm happy to start us off since we do have quite a few people missing tonight.
Yeah.
But hopefully we'll make up for that with our brilliance. They won't miss the other really brilliant people who aren't here. But Amandil's errand, it's interesting because we don't know anything about it other than he just takes off and leaves. But it seems like, at least partially, it was successful because the Valar do seem to save the faithful. You know, they create that big wave that sort of brings them to Middle Earth. And it does seem like they're separated out. It's not just the fact that they're ready, but they also sort of get some special treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, even if it didn't succeed in that, he doesn't succeed like Arendelle did. At least partially, he must have gotten through somehow. And gotten the message through. So that's what I think. But, you know, it's all speculation because it's not in the text.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think actually for one thing is kind of interesting in itself. So, I mean, even before we look further into the answer to that question, just the fact that it is a question, I think, tells us something interesting about this story. Think about the differences, for instance, with the story of Arendelle. Arendelle leaves Middle-earth, and the story follows him, and we're out on the sea with Arendelle, and Elwing comes and meets him, and then we get his arrival in Valinor, and then it shifts back to Middle-earth. You'll remember when Vingolot with the Silmaril rises, the new star rises in the sky for the first time, and we get that discussion between Maglor and Maedhros, who are like, "Dude, look at that!" And everybody who's left in Middle-earth, all of the good guys left in Middle-earth, who of course are not terribly numerous at that point, are seeing. So we get this one brief glimpse of what it looks like from Middle-earth. Here, it's like we stay on that side. You know, we don't, you know, the messenger departs and sails off into, you know, into unexplored seas on a desperate attempt to get through. And we don't know any more about it. Remember, there was uncertainty as to whether or not Eärendil got through. He never returned to Middle-earth. And it's not until, you know, his intervention in the battle that anybody sees anything of him or knows anything about what happened. Now, of course, like, all of a sudden, you know, the army of Valinor shows up and starts kicking Morgoth's butt. But still, they had no idea actually what happened with Eärendil. So the point that I'm making here is the difference in the perspective of this story, whereas that one followed the Mariner and gave us the not quite omniscient standpoint, but basically clearly the standpoint from those who were there, essentially the Valinorian standpoint, because we even hear, you know, the debate of the Council of the Valar talking about what to do with Eärendil after he walks out of the room. In other words, like most of the rest of the Silmarillion, the story of Eärendil is told from an elvish perspective that is handed down from people who were conversant with the Valar, and many of these stories, like the Ainulindale, like the story of the early history of the First Age before the arising of the elves, that stuff all comes secondhand from the Valar themselves, from elves who knew them. Here, we don't get that, and the perspective stays closer to the Numenorean perspective. Amondil sails off into the distance, and we don't know what happens. Did he land in Valinor and have an Eärendil moment? Maybe, we don't know. That's a question that's really left open, not just by the sort of mystery of his disappearance and, you know, Laura, as you point out, what could certainly at the very least be taken as indirect evidence that he did get through based upon the fact that Elendil and his people were saved, but that reminder that we get there at the bottom of 279, but whether or no it were that Amondil came indeed to Valinor and Manwë hearkened to his prayer, by grace of the Valar, Elendil and his sons and their people were spared from the ruin of that day. So again, the question is floated, whether it happened or not, we don't really know, but so that, I think, is sort of an interesting reminder. But again, there have been a couple moments in this story, that is in the Akalabeth, when I've asked the question, or we've been kind of thinking about, what perspective is this from? Is this an elven story, or is this actually a human story told from the human perspective? Are we supposed to understand that this story is basically given to us by the survivors of Numenor, handed down amongst, you know, the generations of Numenoreans in Middle-earth, and that's where this story comes from? Or is this another elven story? And I think that this this moment, the uncertainty of what happened with Amondil, is an interesting possibility anyway, to suggest that maybe this really is an actual a human Numenorean perspective story rather than an elvish story, and is therefore somewhat different from the rest of the Silmarillion. But anyway, that is a long digression about the full question. Corey, Jordan, go ahead.
If that's the case, then how do we know the ending of this story where, like, they get to Valinor and they land their ships and they're crushed underneath sand? If it's a story of men, I mean, Elendil and Isildur would have no idea of what took place other than, you know, like, the great wave that cast them aside. So, at the very least, it would have to be both elves and men telling this story together, wouldn't it?
You'd think. I mean, I agree. There are certainly moments which do sound more elvish. And that's a good point. I mean, though, again, even there, we're not really given, compare and contrast with the Eärendil story. We don't get anything like dialogue, for instance. Think of the details that we get in the Eärendil story. I mean, at the time we were talking about how compressed that was, the Eärendil story, and how little detail we got other than sort of a few things which kind of float in, like the moment that Mike and I both liked about Elwing's, you know, hair being on his face as he woke up to discover that his wife had returned to her form. However, think again of in the arrival in Valinor, we really do get a bunch of detail. We get that business about him leaving the ship and Elwing and him saying, I'm going to go by myself, and Elwing jumping off and doing the Luthien bit. No, I'm coming with you. We get dialogue. We get, you know, his exactly the path that he travels and looking around in that strange, the strange sort of moment of anticlimax when he looks around and the place looks deserted. And then we get Eonwe's speech to him and him coming back. And then we get the debate among the Valar. All we get with our Farazan are some general, the general trend of the story there. That is, we get, the fact that the ship sailed and they surrounded Tol Eressëa and they landed and they didn't meet anybody because the elves had withdrawn, and then whammo. That's all that we get. And that's, it's a very different kind of story, which almost could be the story of somebody who doesn't actually know what happened, and is just giving the, giving sort of the basic gist of what is their fate. So I don't know. I don't know, but I do think that it is, I do think that it is an interesting point. Chris, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, just, an observation. We do, as far as what perspective that the story might be told from, or different parts of the story, we do get a little bit of information of, our Farazan and the king's, and his army, so it might imply that some information got back probably by way of the elves to Middle-earth to convey that part of the story. However, no news of Amandil, if that, you know, if that train of thought holds any water at all. Since there's no news of Amandil, it almost would, might suggest that he never got there. And so there was no news to give of him because he was never there. Just a thought again. Nothing definitive, but just that occurred to me.
Right, right. Or that the people of Middle-earth were on a need-to-know basis and not told about Amandil. That something about the fate of the Numenorean king and his army was sort of spread about, but that nobody was told about Amandil and whether he got through or not. I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to... I'm actually not really sure myself whether I think that Amandil got through or not. I can see some reasons pro and con. Yeah. Sorry, Chris, go ahead. Did you want to say something more?
Nope. That's why we discuss it.
Right.
We don't really know.
Right.
Toss it around.
Right. Jack?
Jordan, go ahead. As far as Amandil goes, would he have even really needed to land on Valinor to have gotten his message across? I mean, shouldn't Ulmo have been aware? I mean, clearly they're aware of Elendil and Isildur on the other side of the island. Shouldn't they have been aware then of Amandil and what his mission was? Isn't it plausible that even if he didn't make it to Valinor, his message still was received loud and clear?
He certainly suggests that. I mean, that's kind of... It's the comment that I think is most interesting about Amandil's journey is when Elendil asks him, would you then betray the king? For you know well the charge that they make against us, that we are traitors and spies, and that until this day it has been false. If I thought that Manwë needed such a messenger, said Amandil, I would betray the king, for there is but one loyalty from which no man can be absolved in heart for any cause. If I thought that Manwë needed such a messenger, I would betray the king. So there is a sense in which he is saying, really, there's no point to this journey. That is, I don't actually need to accomplish anything. I have no information to give to the Valar that they don't already have. You know, it's not like our Farazan is going to catch them by surprise or something like that, or even the message that he wants to give about, oh, hi, you know, the faithful are being persecuted and, like, bad people are doing bad things to the good guys. That's not a piece of information that the Valar appear to need either. Certainly Amandil doesn't think that they need to receive that information, and yet he's going to go anyway. Clearly he believes the voyage worth making, even though it's not actually necessary. He's going to make this voyage as a messenger, even though he doesn't think the message is actually necessary. And that, I think, is a really a very suggestive and revealing point about Imandil's whole point of view here and what it means for him to be a messenger to the Valar. Remember, another really interesting thing about this moment and about Imandil's voyage, it is Imandil who breaks the ban of the Valar. He is the first Numenorean to break the ban and sail into the West. It's not Ar-Pharazôn who does it. Ar-Pharazôn's all fixing to do it and setting out to do it. But Amandil, the good guy, actually beats him to it and is the first one to break the ban. And that, again, I think is kind of interesting, too. Jack?
Yeah, just on the larger subject of sources, I think it's really fascinating to try and figure out where it comes from. And I remember when I first started reading Silmarillion, realizing that most of this is from the Elfin perspective. That was a key to the book for me, so it really opened my eyes. But also, aren't there places in the Silmarillion where the information, there's just no explanation for where it comes from? I'm thinking, for example, I remember when early on when Melkor and Ungoliant were off in the wastelands talking to each other. You know, we're getting word-for-word conversation from them. And I just couldn't think of me for the life of me where the information was coming from. And there must be other places like that.
Right. Well, and that's exactly what I think that we need to be careful not to be over literal in thinking about where the information comes from. Jack, that's a brilliant brilliant instance of exactly this kind of thing. When we say where it comes from and who's reporting it, it's not to say that like somebody was there with like a digital recorder, you know, or you know, like somebody was in the bushes taking dictation when Morgoth and Ungoliant were speaking. And that's pretty typical for the genre of what all of this is, which is legend. That, you know, all of this is designed to be and to appear to be and to sound like ancient legendary material. And in ancient legendary material, there tends to be very little, there's really no attempt at what, you know, something that we might think of as like journalistic accuracy, like somebody there actually taking down the whole conversation and reporting it accurately. When two characters speak to each other in, you know, in legends and epics and things like that, it's not like, and this is what they said word for word, but rather we know that Morgoth and Ungoliant spoke, you know, we know that they collaborated and that they came into Valinor together. So here I, the bard, I, the teller of the tale, am going to give you a conversation between Morgoth and Ungoliant to talk about, to give the sense of their conversation, of the pact that they made to join together in order to destroy the trees. And if you go back and look at the conversation, we don't get, there's very, it doesn't sound like a normal conversation. This actually, I think, is one of the reasons, another one of the reasons stylistically people have a hard time with the Silmarillion, because they want to be able to get into it like a novel, you know, to see sort of realistic, what they would call realistic dialogue, like two people talking to one another. And people, you know, I've heard people say about conversations in the Silmarillion, who talks like that? Nobody talks like that. Well, that's not the point. Yes, there are people who talk like that. You know who talk like that? Bards and epic poets. That's who talks like that. And that's what it is. You know, so in that conversation, it's not like, you know, Morgoth and Ungoliant hanging out. That is a poetic treatment of the meeting of these two, you know, the birth of the collaboration of these two wicked people. So similarly, when we get, and you know, and the same thing could be said, the same explanation, I think, could be given, to some extent anyway, of the debate among the Valar over the fate of Eärendil, for instance. We know that this must have happened. We know that they must have talked about this. We can tell because we know that this is what they decided. And, you know, here is kind of what it might have looked like, or here is the gist of that. Anyway, so I think it's an important thing to keep in mind when we're looking at, you know, who is saying what and who is relating what, because there don't actually have to have been eyewitnesses. And again, that's where I come back to what we get of Ar-Pharazôn's attack on Valinor. If this were actually, you know, if we were being given an eyewitness account, if we were being given an actual description of what happened, I think it might well be very different. What we're given is a poetical account, you know, with some interesting poetic and mythic touches. I think, for instance, of the detail that we're given about the sadness of the elves of Tol Eressëa when the sails of the Númenóreans blot out the light of the setting sun from Valinor. But these are not exactly realistic details, in the sense in which we would expect them in a realistic novel, or the kind of up close account that we have gotten on some occasions at various points in the Silmarillion. Joe, go ahead.
Well, and if it was a first hand account of the elves in Valinor, it would go more of the, and then we ran like cowards because it turns out men are our equals in some things.
At least the Númenóreans, who have been gaining physical stature and power anyway for a long time. I prefer to think of that as a tactical retreat on the part of the elves. Basically, they're doing what the Valar is doing, which is clearly everybody on the Valinor side doesn't want to fight this fight, and doesn't actually want to have a war with the Númenóreans. I do think that, I mean, as we talked about before, as Tolkien suggests in one of his letters, the Númenóreans, they could have done some serious damage had a war been had battle been joined. But I don't think it's, it is merely fear of losing. Again, as we see reflected in the response of Manwë and the other Valar. But we're getting ahead of ourselves here. Joe, go ahead.
All right. I don't really have a definite stance on whether Imondil made it and lived or not. Just that, but you see this other times throughout the book, like when Uor is talking to Turgon. He says, "With the eyes of death, I say this." And Imondil says something similar. He says, he said farewell to all his household as one that is about to die. He said, "May it prove that you see me never again." All this and all that gives a goodbye speech, and then and it says further down the next paragraph, "Men could not a second time be saved by such an embassy, and for the treason of Numenor, there was no easy absolving." Now, this makes me lean more towards the case that he didn't make it, but I guess you never know. It just seems like more of a definite, yeah, he definitely wasn't going to survive it. It's whenever you see someone speak like that in the Silmarillion, it never ends well for them.
Right. There is something of the, this I say with, him seeing with the eyes of death as Huor does in the Fens of Sarek. Yeah. No, I think he's definitely going to die one way or the other. And I think certainly, I think that to me, the main difference there, you think about the differences between Imondil's situation and Eärendil's situation as messengers. Eärendil shows up as the representative of the Edain and the Eldar in Middle-earth, because of course he's both. He's half and half by blood, and he is the lord of, all of the survivors together. But he really is speaking on behalf of everybody. That is, all the good guys. Yes, we're all being oppressed by the enemy, by Morgoth and his servants, but all the elves and men who are left in Beleriand, I'm speaking on their behalf. Imondil, of course, isn't. And the biggest difference is that Imondil is basically, if he is appealing on behalf of Numenor, well, he's not actually representing Numenor. Who does he represent? He represents the faithful, but as we know, the faithful were a minority in Numenor, and by now are a really small minority in Numenor. And the rest of the Númenóreans, if what he is seeking is clemency for Numenor, please don't smite Numenor. Well, like, while he's doing this, everybody, Ar-Pharazôn continues to arm, and Numenor is still headed towards hell just as fast in the same handbasket. So, go ahead, Jordan.
Yes, Joe.
Oh, it's Joe. Go ahead.
But one thing I was going to say, I don't know if this has much evidence behind it or not, but one thing, I mean, you said that Imondil was the first one to break the ban of the Valar, and then later on you see that Ar-Pharazôn has that moment of hesitation, and it seems like Imondil may have been able to give him that moment of hesitation by being the first one to break it. Maybe since it was already broken, I mean, maybe he kind of took the blunt of the Valar, like, all right, you're going to go ahead and die, and when Ar-Pharazôn comes over, he'll have the chance to do what he wants. That's really not very thought out very well. It popped into my head.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that I do love that moment too when Ar-Pharazôn hesitates. And it is, there's something almost, not quite comical, but almost comical. And it's like, I'm about to break the ban of the Valar. And it's like, dude, actually the ban of Valar was just broken, like, you know, a few hours ago. But yeah, I mean, that even he hesitates in that moment. But yeah, no, I think that's good. But anyway, as I say, I do think there's a significant difference. What Amando is asking, it's not even exactly obvious what he is asking. Eärendil, his message is a little clearer. Please forgive the Noldor, and please come save us, because we're getting stomped on over here by Morgoth. What Amando is asking is much, I think, much less clear. He says, therefore I am minded to try that counsel which our forefather Eärendil took of old, to sail into the west, be their ban or no, and to speak to the Valar, even to Manwë himself, if may be, and beseech his aid ere all is lost. Beseech his aid is pretty vague. That's not a plan, really. Really, he seems to be throwing himself on the mercy of the Valar. And then, you know, Laura, we come back to the point that you made earlier. Well, it seems that the aid was given, and especially Manwë's aid, because it's a wind which saves Elendil and the rest of their company. This wild wind which comes out of the west and blows them before the wave. So whether or not he got there, they do appear to receive the aid of Manwë. John, do you have your mic now? I know you had wanted to talk about Amandil too, so before we moved on from that, I wanted to give you the chance to do that. Okay, sorry. If it's you can feel free to jump in, John, if you can turn on your mic here in a minute. I'll just mention one of the points that you mentioned in the class notes. I agree with you. I think there is this sense that Sauron, in his plan here, has indeed underestimated or forgotten Eru. Remember, the line that he's feeding to Ar-Pharazôn is that Eru is made up, right? That there's no such thing as Eru. Eru is a lie that's told by the elves and the Valar, and it's just a conspiracy to keep everybody else down and to give them power. And he whispers at first to Ar-Pharazôn the name of Melkor, who is the true master of all. And it is almost like he has bought his own line. Surely Sauron himself knows perfectly well that he is telling a lie to Ar-Pharazôn. I don't think that Sauron himself is actually an atheist. However, there is that. I mean, that the moment when Sauron falls in Numenor is this sort of the delightful irony and justice of him, you know, sitting there and cackling in satisfaction and triumph, you know, that he has won, and then, you know, the bottom drops out and down he goes into the abyss. And it is like he has actually started to buy his own. He has started to buy his own lies. Joe, I think a while back, before we sort of shifted away from it, you had said you had something you wanted to say about Isildur.
Yeah, just wanted to talk about when he went and saved the tree. Pretty much, you know, he fights his way to it, saves it, and then it says he's on the brink of death, and he gets it back, and it says he's sick until the first leaf opens after they plant it, and then, you know, he says he arises in trouble no more by his wounds. And I wonder, I mean, if that healing would have come from a gift of the Valar or possibly Iluvatar. I just wasn't sure because, I mean, Iluvatar works more directly with men, but I'm pretty sure that the tree was a gift from the Valar, so I just didn't know how that would kind of relate. And it's just interesting how you see the Valar also work with the Faithful Still or Iluvatar, whoever it was, how, okay, you're willing to do this. This is great, so yeah, we'll heal you. No big deal.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that that's a great question. And I think, you know, basically the way that I deal with that passage is this seems to me much more kind of metaphorical than that. I mean, the clear thing that we get is the connection, the thing that that moment in the story emphasizes is Isildur's connection with the tree. And remember, this is already the significance that the tree has been given. Sauron wants Ar-Pharazôn to cut it down. He wants him to cut it down for a reason. But even Ar-Pharazôn is reluctant to cut down the white tree. At first, the king would not assent to this. This is the bottom of 272. Since he believed that the fortunes of his house were bound up with the tree, as was forespoken by Tar Palantir. So Tar Palantir, the foresighted, has said the fate of the house of Elros is tied up with the fate of the white tree. And here we see in Isildur, whom we know he is the heir. We've got Amandil and his heir Elendil and Elendil's heir Isildur. And Isildur is, we see his own survival. Isildur himself is like the fruit of the tree, the fruit that survives, which is going to bear the new tree and therefore the promise of the new future. The new future line, that is like Isildur himself. He is quite young. He's a kid, Isildur, as we're told. And I mean, not like six or something, but he's young. He's maybe, I don't know, the Numenoreans live longer, so the ages would mean something different stuff to them. But anyway, we're told that he is young. And he takes this fruit, and then we see this explicit connection between his own health, and Isildur's survival. When its first leaf opened, then Isildur, who had lain long and come near to death, arose and was troubled no more by his wounds, as you read, Joe. And that's, he is healed by the tree, just as he has, in preserving the tree, also sort of metaphorically, preserved the sanctity of the line of the descendants of Elros, which he is and which he is going to be. So I'm not sure basically even how literally I take that. That is, you know, the mechanism there doesn't seem to me quite as important as the kind of overall sort of mythic shape of that moment. But Chris, go ahead.
I was reminding when at the part of the bottom of 273, when Sauron finally gets his way and the tree is burned, and the effect that has, first of all, there's a smoke that covers the land, and then it slowly passes into the west. And so I was reminded of, like Saruman, he tries to go into the west and gets blown away. It's almost like the tree is a being in and of itself, the way its essence or spirit, whatever you want to call it. They just say it's smoke, but I found it very evocative of things that, you know, go into the west.
That's a wonderful point. I'd never really thought about that before, but it's like the unquiet spirit of the tree of Nimloth, looming above Numenor, itself like a portent. And then, as you say, it's hard to ignore when you pay attention to it, that slowly it passed into the west. That's a great point. I mean, I think that that's a really neat way to think about that passage. It's like Nimloth, as you say, almost like the spirit of Nimloth returning back where it came into the west. And it is also, it's a moment when another threshold has clearly been crossed. Another line has been crossed in the rebellion of the Numenoreans. There was the change of the language, you know, the change of the names of the king. That was a big line. This is a big line. The burning of the tree was a really big line. Again, Sauron wanted that to happen
it's
for
almost
a reason.
Like the,
go ahead.
It's almost the final straw. I mean, and of course we've got the attack on Valinor coming, but as far as, you know, the last of the symbolism that held them to the west, that was the tree. Now it's burnt. You know, there's absolutely no going back after that point, it seems.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, that this is, it is after that that the sort of apocalyptic stuff in Numenor really starts to happen. John?
Well, going back to, you know, not to digress greatly on the Sauron points, especially, you know, in regards to his downfall, and especially tying into the White Tree of Nimloth, it seems like going back to the earlier reports of the wise lord Palantir, Tar Palantir, you know, how the line of the kings basically will be tied to basically the fortune of basically Nimloth and the descendants of Nimloth the Fair. And basically this same seed, the same root, basically continues on in regards to, you know, in the Third Age. I remember quite clearly there was that conversation in The Return of the King between Gandalf and Aragorn in regards to how basically the line of the tree needs to be preserved, how it is older, and how it's basically greater than, you know, even his line of the, you know, the lords of Isildur and the descendants of Isildur. And the fact that Isildur is here mentioned in that kind of detail, not basically that one little segment. Because later on, especially in something the films have done, you know, to Isildur's character, is after his, you know, fall into the Lord of the Ring, we don't basically get a, you know, untempted Isildur in that adaptation. And here we basically get an early version, early basically sketch of his character, where we have almost like a three-part family dynamic here. We have Amandil, who essentially sets the standard for wisdom. Then we have Elendil, who's carrying on the same torch, and after him Isildur. And with basically this kind of dynamic working together, we get the sense that this minority, the faithful, has a voice. That's what I feel, especially artistically. The fact that it actually does have a voice in the text is different from, for example, a wide description of Arfarazôn at the ending, where he, you know, he wavers upon his invasion of the Undying Lands. And that's why I think it holds precedent in the text.
Yeah, John, I think that that's, you're certainly right that we should be remembering. And I think that it's certainly one of the important functions of this one little Isildur story that we get here is this, the way in which that passage serves as a bridge to the Third Age stuff. Not only the Third Age stuff that we're going to get in the next section, you know, the section we're going to get to next week, but also the portion of the Third Age that we already know about. Isildur has been part of the story from the beginning, that is part of the Lord of the Rings story, which, you know, the Silmarillion is put together with the assumption that everyone who reads it is going to have read the Lord of the Rings. It was of course published posthumously, and even when Tolkien was working on it in his later days, it was still after the publication of the Lord of the Rings, and in response to the popularity of the Lord of the Rings that publishers actually became interested in publishing it. So you know, it's sort of in that sense presumed that we know that story, and therefore that this reference to Isildur is going to really resonate with us, and that we're going to be able to see the seeds not only of the kingship, but John, as you say, to see, knowing what we know of Isildur, which is not only his taking of his defeat of Sauron ultimately, but also his taking of the ring and of his at least struggling with the temptation of the ring and his being betrayed by the ring, you know, it does give this moment a little bit of a taste of tragedy, because we know how his story is going to end. And seeing it start this way, I think, puts it in a context which I think is really interesting. But good. Well, let's go on to the reaction of the Valar. Oh, wait, Mike, you had a... Jordan, go ahead.
One thing quickly on Sauron before we hop ahead.
Sure.
I don't think we talked about it last week. Well, first of all, when he says, you know, like when we talk about how he's an atheist, but yeah, obviously not, I don't think he could have possibly expected Iluvatar's actual interaction with the world, because we've never seen that before. But besides that, one of the things I found really interesting, and I don't think we talked about it last week, was that Sauron still, when he's like telling Numenor about, you know, like the great dark master, he's telling them it's Morgoth, which seems sort of bizarre that he's still that loyal to Morgoth, even though, like, you would think at that point he'd be like, hey, you know who's the master of the dark? I am.
Right.
And instead is, you know, clearly saying, like, oh, no, there's someone out there much more powerful than me, and he's coming back. And I don't know if he really believes that, or if he's just so loyal that he won't say anything bad against Morgoth.
It's a great question. I mean, I was, you know, Jordan, it's funny you should say that. When I was rereading this earlier today, that was the thing that really jumped out at me reading it through this time. And I was asking myself exactly that question. Isn't it interesting that Sauron at least still appears to be faithful? It's hard for me to imagine that he really is just like so devoted that he is, you know, that he's still acting that way out of pure selfless devotion. But he is not elevating himself. Now, again, I think there are lots of things that could potentially be said about that. You know, you could say, well, it's strategy. I mean, right? I mean, he's just, if he just sets up to say, like, actually, I am God, you should be worshiping me right now, that's, you know, sort of a lot more obvious and going to be a lot more suspicious. Whereas if he seems to be giving secret knowledge, and even, of course, secret knowledge that does have some power behind it. We know that we're told at the end of the Quintus Silmarillion that not only does Morgoth still exist, but that his power is still felt in the world. And doubtless, Sauron will remember, and we know he has been making capital out of the fact that men have always feared the dark. And, you know, that the Numenoreans, you know, in one sense, as we described, the story of the Numenorean culture at the beginning is this rising up out of darkness and into light. However, it's still there, and sort of the memory of it in a sense is still there. So maybe he's just like, you know, he thinks this is the best way to get it done. We do see that moment when he's defying the lightning and men call him a god. So it's not at all obvious to me that getting himself deified isn't perhaps in the long-term plan, even though that's not his initial move there. But all of those things said, I still think that that's a fascinating thing, given the context back in the Vala Quinta, when we're told that the only thing that made him less evil than Morgoth was that for a while he served somebody else and not just himself. And so at the very least, we're getting a kind of echo of that, which I do think is kind of suggestive, even if it's still out of fear, that he, Sauron, is not yet going to go around and just kind of ignoring or writing off Morgoth completely, because, you know, someday he might come back, and what if he wins, and then Sauron wants still to have a job after that. So yeah, I think but I do agree that that's a really interesting passage. Moving on to the actual downfall of Numenor and the response of Ilúvatar, Mike, you had a style time moment that you wanted to do. There was a paragraph you wanted to read.
You'll indulge me. It's the paragraph where Tolkien lists all of the things in a sort of summary sentence that are lost mm-hmm. when Numenor slides down into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Then suddenly fire burst from the Meneltarma, and there came a mighty wind and a tumult of the earth, and the sky reeled, and the hills slid, and Numenor went down into the sea with all its children, and its wives, and its maidens, and its ladies proud, and all its gardens, and its halls, and its towers, its tombs, and its riches, and its jewels, and its webs, and its things painted and carven, and its laughter, and its mirth, and its music, its wisdom, and its lore. They vanished forever.
That is a fantastic sentence. Now, you were particularly interested in the colon there at the end?
Yeah, I'm wondering what's going on with the colon that separates the list of, you know, sort of what made up Numenor versus what happened to it after the colon. And I'm also interested in the sequence of how things are listed there, starting with children and ending, or maybe culminating in a way, I don't know, with legend and lore. I'm sorry, wisdom and lore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. This is a really fascinating sentence to look at from a couple different things. We start with the fire bursting from the Meneltarma, and the mighty wind and tumult of earth, and the sky reeled, and the hills slid. So we've got this, you know, the whole... We, of course, know the significance of the Meneltarma. That was the holy place to Eru, the only place of worship that is explicitly described anywhere in Tolkien's work, and it's exploding in fire, which is not a good sign. And then we have what starts to, like, it's just going to be like, you know, we're just going to have this apocalyptic description. Oh, wind, earthquake, the sky reeled, the hills slid, okay, then everything was destroyed. And Numenor went down into the sea. And if we got a period there, it would still be a pretty cool sentence, but not all that much sort of interesting. But then, Mike, now starts the part of it that you were really focusing on, right? With all, the with all, you know, what exactly went down with Numenor? It's children, it's wives, it's maidens and ladies proud. So we've got the people first, and these are, of course, the people left, because all of the men and warriors have gone over to Valinor. And it is an interesting progression. Children, wives, maidens, and ladies proud. Gardens and its hills and its towers, its tombs and its riches, its jewels and its webs and its things painted and carven, its laughter and its mirth and its music, its wisdom and its lore. They vanished forever. And they're clearly in sets, right? You've got its people, its buildings, essentially, its architecture. Gardens count there because those would have been designed and laid out as well. Its tombs and its riches. The connection between tombs and riches there is really fascinating. Of course, we talked about the tombs and the mummies and everything, the sort of the fixation on tombs that was growing up in Numenor. And the connection between those two things, that, like, the, you know, them storing up riches for themselves is really just like, even in their lives, when they're building themselves amazing palaces and gathering wealth and wealth and wealth, it's still kind of like the same thing as them building themselves enormous tombs. And then specifically, its jewels and its webs and its things painted and carven. Now, hang on, why did we just go from riches to jewels? They're in two different sets. Its tombs and its riches, its jewels and its webs and its thing. Why is jewels not included in the previous one? Any thoughts on that? No? I know there aren't that many of you tonight. What's the theme of that third set? Its jewels and its webs and its things painted and carven. Yeah, Chris, I agree. Say that aloud for our listeners.
Art is what I was thinking of. I think of the Noldor, you know, making the jewels. I mean, that, I don't know, the Numenoreans didn't, but it kind of fits in with the rest of the sentence then, if you think of things that are artistic.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I think the riches, at first, this is clearly a bad thing associated with their tombs. It talks of, that seems to point to basically the sort of pointless vanity, even self-destructive vanity of the Numenoreans vanishes forever. But also its jewels and its webs and its things painted and carven, the works of their hands. They made some pretty awesome stuff. And that stuff was not a bad thing. I don't think that we're supposed to see their jewels. And we already get, like, its children, its wives, and its maidens and ladies proud. The pride of the ladies is presumably not a good thing. The loss of its children and wives and maidens, at least, is tragic. The loss of the jewels and the webs and things painted and carven is tragic, as is its laughter and its mirth and its music. Laughter and mirth are two things that haven't been associated with Numenor in a long time. And I think in the context of music there, again, we're supposed to be things of beauty. Oh, webs, tapestries. Web almost always means tapestry. Even the common last name Weber, if you know somebody whose last name is Weber, that means they were that originally that was one of those occupational last names, like Smith and Cooper. A Weber was a tapestry maker. So anyway, that's what webs are. Storied webs, you may remember, are also hung in the halls of Mandos. His wife, Vire, is busily making storied webs, meaning tapestries that with narratives on them, pictorial narratives. It's laughter and its mirth and its music, its wisdom and its lore. And Mike, I agree with you. I think it is clearly sort of in the place of honor that its wisdom and lore are mentioned. Even just the even-handedness of this list, I think, is really fascinating, that we get not only, this is not just pure nostalgia, but it's also not condemnation, not simply condemnation either. it would be easy to make a list that goes in either one of those ways. That is, we could easily make a, you know, we could easily imagine a list in which you have, like, and all the pride and vanity of Numenor, the cruelty and the heartlessness, the rebellion and, you know, the discontent and all those things. You know, all things which point in that direction. And it all fell into the abyss, like it deserved. Like, that would be one way to approach this. The other way would be, as I said, pure nostalgia. Like, oh, the great things. Numenor was so awesome, and now it's all gone forever. That would be another way, and again, that's another easy way to imagine how that list would go. But to go, to do it the way that, that he does, to recognize both of those things, their tombs and their riches and their ladies proud at the same time as we get their children and their mirth and laughter and music and wisdom, is to really show a more balanced picture than we've seen of Numenor in pages and pages, when we've just seen it continually sliding into corruption for so long. We get this brief memory of, not only was it not all bad, it was really quite good, though corrupted, all focused on tombs and riches at the end. It was, the loss of Numenor is a genuine loss. Mike?
An exact parallel, but I was reminded of Melkor and Ungoliant before they, you know, come down from the mountain to attack the trees. There was that moment that we lingered on where we get a sort of view of the whole landscape.
Yes.
Before everything is ruined. So, and that landscape is pure beauty and pure goodness. There's no sort of intermingling of the good and the bad. But sort of the same spirit here, that we get one final opportunity to take it all in before it's destroyed.
Yeah. No, I agree. There is a kind of... That's a neat connection. I remember you making that point back when we were talking about that. And I think that is... We do get that kind of, let us pause to review. This is, you know, that this sentence itself, like, this sentence is the memorial of Numenor, to some extent. And I think that we can see that same thing. That sentence that you were recalling, if I'm remembering it rightly, was like a memorial of the bliss of Valinor before it was marred, by the darkening. Good. Well, what do you make of the actual consequences? Tell me what, you know, what you found interesting, or what kind of questions you had or thoughts that you had about the response to the attack of Ar-Pharazôn. What Manwë does, what Iluvatar does. Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking, why, and this is actually Dave's point, I sort of wondered it myself as well, why the Valar themselves don't engage. They sort of sit back and say, you know what? This isn't like the Battle of Wrath, or this isn't like anything else, although, of course, we know the Valar didn't go to the Battle of Wrath, but they didn't send out their heralds, they didn't send out their armies. They sat back completely and said, Iluvatar is going to take care of this one for us. And sort of why they just completely sit back, is it, and the theory Dave was wondering was that, is it just for fear that if they did engage them, they would lose massive amounts of life, or is it maybe something else that we're missing?
Well, my own answer to that is both. Both that they want to avoid the unnecessary bloodshed because they know this is not going to be a problem that's just going to be solved by slaughtering the Numenoreans with difficulty, but rather this is a bigger thing. But Chris, did you want to add something?
Yes, I guess it occurs to me back in the music, it almost seems like the Valar realize that that men are more under the purview of Iluvatar than their own. So I've always viewed it as they're stepping back and letting Iluvatar deal with these troublesome beings that he's brought forth.
Dude, these are your problem, okay? thought this whole mortal thing was a good idea. You deal with this.
Well, not to be facetious, but that the third theme, deal with the children of Iluvatar. Well, we've got the elves, and the Valar seem to, at least to a degree, understand them. They don't seem to have a clue about men, and so I've always saw that as they saw Iluvatar having more authority over men than, and then they didn't. not stating that very well, but
no, I agree. I mean, I'm not sure I would put it in quite that way. That is the, because I mean, Manwë is clear. I mean, he is the vice regent of Iluvatar on the Earth. So it's not like men are outside of his jurisdiction exactly.
True.
But I do agree with you. I mean, I think about it still in a similar kind of way. That is that Manwë recognizes that this is not just about him. That, you know, that this is, that if he were to step in and do some smiting on the Numenoreans, he would essentially be kind of breaking in on something which isn't really about him, I think. But Laura, go ahead.
Well, I think that Eru had to get involved because this involves changing the shape of, I'm sorry, my brain is shut off tonight. I can't think of the names of anything, of Arda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, he's getting rid of Numenor, but he's also changing the world so that it's round instead of flat. And that's something that the Valar couldn't do. You know, they had to call on Eru to have him do that for them because they wanted to remove this temptation from mankind to come to Valinor, and that's not something they could do on their own.
So yeah,
I think that's why they had to involve Iluvatar.
Well, I see, and though yes, I agree. Though I think I would say the cause and effect goes the other way there. That is, that's what Iluvatar does. When they leave it up to him, which I think does sort of suggest that it was the correct response to the situation, and certainly the Valar, I don't think, could have done that. But I don't think we could quite say that, like, the Valar saw that this needed happening, and so, I mean, basically, we would want to avoid, I think, thinking that the Valar are essentially using Iluvatar as a subcontractor here. I'm not saying that you're suggesting that, but that seems to me, in some sense, kind of the logical extension of it. Like, you know, do you need a really big job done? Get Iluvatar to do it. But rather that they genuinely leave it. I mean, the words that are used about Manwë there are quite, I mean, I remember the first time I read this, and I found it kind of shocking. The first half of the sentence I didn't find shocking, the second half I did. Then Manwë upon the mountain called upon Iluvatar. That didn't shock me. And for that time the Valar laid down their government of Arda. That's the part that surprised me. I was like, wait, I was all ready for a smiting. Especially with the whole, I mean, there's almost the equivalent of smack talk going on between the Valar and the Numenoreans, right? The Numenoreans are all, I mean, literally talking smack, like yelling outwards to the west, you know, and making various discourteous and rebellious gestures in the direction of Valinor. But the whole thing with, like, we are sending huge clouds in the shape of eagles with lightning coming down underneath it, and they're actually picking off people again, and this is a Manwë thing, the lightning, right? He's actually picking off people with lightning in the streets and in the fields and everything. You know, it's hard not to read that as Manwë, you know, calling out, you know, not calling out the Numenoreans, but telling the Numenoreans, like, hey, you want a piece of me? Look here, you want a piece of me? This is what it's going to be like. And so when they come over, you know, when the response of the Numenoreans to that is basically, yeah, bring it, tough guy. We're coming to you, and we're going to take you down. I was ready for the Valar to give them the whooping that they richly deserve. And that's not what I find. Instead, what I find is, you know, Manwë's response is to set aside his authority, to lay down their government of Arda. They just leave it entirely up to Iluvatar. They say, hey, you take over. You decide what is best to do. In a sense, they're submitting themselves to judgment. They're just appealing this case to the higher court. And clearly submitting to Iluvatar as well, laying down their government. Now, apparently, Eru gives them their government back again, he doesn't, if this is a letter of resignation, Eru doesn't accept it, it seems. But basically they are appealing to an arbiter, and there's at least the implication, hey, maybe that, you know, not that it's actually likely that the decision is going to go against them. It's pretty clear who are the good guys and who are the bad guys here. But again, they're kind of putting themselves on that footing where they too are just coming before the judgment seat. Again, not quite on equal ground with the Numenoreans, but on a heck of a lot more equal ground than I would have expected at first. Mike?
Right after that sentence, Iluvatar showed forth his power. That starts with but.
Yes.
When the Valar appeal, are they then appealing with an anticipation that there will be some non-violent judgment from Iluvatar? And does the but indicate that they were not expecting the more violent reaction?
I think it's that's exactly the kind of observation I've come to expect from you, Mike. I agree that but is really interesting. But Iluvatar showed forth his power. The thing I get from that but is certainly that this is not what they expected to happen. I don't know if it's not what they wanted to happen, but it's certainly not what they expected to happen. But Iluvatar showed forth his power. This is why I don't think that they were angling for what happened. I think that they are as surprised as anybody else at the quite remarkable measures that Iluvatar takes here to separate Middle-earth from the Valar. And the point that I've made before, the point that I have, you know, that I make in my Tolkien class when we get here, is, you know, what Iluvatar does is take the ban of the Valar and make it permanent. Make it now it's not just I'm going to rely upon your will to resist the temptation to sail into the West. I'm going to expect you not to sail into the West. This is what the Valar do with the Numenoreans. You could sail into the West, but don't. And Iluvatar is saying, okay, I'm taking that choice off the table for almost everybody. You know, there will still be a straight road, and maybe somebody, you know, there's still the opportunity for the occasional sort of eucatastrophe. But by and large, I'm slamming that door shut. And the ban of the Valar is going to be made absolute in ways that the Valar themselves don't make it. And this then comes back to also what I think is, you know, the other reason to me that Manwë's response here makes sense. That is, and the reason, you know, Jordan, getting back to the questions that you were asking about, why are they not engaging in battle with the Numenoreans? Ultimately, the Numenoreans are pretty well deluded by this point, and they've been fooling themselves for some time. They think that they are coming to attack the Valar. They think that the Valar are their enemies. But that's because they've convinced themselves, and Sauron has helped in the convincing, that the Valar are keeping the land of eternal life selfishly to themselves and trying to deprive men of it, and have therefore, by some conspiracy among the Valar, kept men down in enforced mortality. But we know that that isn't true. Men are mortal because of the decision of Iluvatar, and as it is described in the Silmarillion, the gift of Iluvatar to men. As the Valar try to explain to the men during the debate back in the middle of the Akalabeth, look, this is Iluvatar's plan. You are actually fighting against Iluvatar. So basically, Manwë is recognizing in that moment, you know what? Actually, though they're saying lots of rude things to me, and they're actually trying to attack us, and their fight is not with us. This is not really a quarrel between the Numenoreans and Valinor. This is really a quarrel between the Numenoreans and Iluvatar himself, because what they are upset about is death. They are upset about the lot that Iluvatar has given them in life, and they are trying to break that. That's the ban that they're really breaking. It's not really the geography thing, not so important. What is really important is that they are trying to break the limit that Iluvatar has set on their existence. That's what they want to do. So, since this is between them and Iluvatar, let's, let Iluvatar and them step outside and take care of this themselves, and we see what happens. Whammo! But it's not just the whammo of, it's not just a violent response, it's not just an epic smiting of the Numenoreans. I mean, it is. But, of course, it's much more than that, too. And ends up being much more complete and much more, I was going to say global, which, of course, it is. Jack?
Yeah, since we're writing this paragraph, and it describes Ar-Pharazôn being, and his men being cast down into the caves of the Forgotten, I'll bring this point up now for Dave. He mentioned in the notes, was Ar-Pharazôn getting what he wanted, but twisted, in immortality, in this paragraph?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a kind of a delightful thing. They do get what they're looking for. That is, they, in a sense, are going to live forever. I mean, they're put into this suspended animation, which it's impossible to me not to connect it with the desire that the Numenoreans have had all along. Hey, look, we're going to live forever. Isn't this awesome? Okay, well, actually, less awesome than it is, not exactly how we pictured things. Elizabeth, go ahead.
Just kind of along that same point, when I was reading that particular sentence about the Numenoreans being imprisoned in the caves of the Forgotten, and this is kind of a stretch, I know, but it made me think about a parallel with the Return of the King and the Oathbreakers, and how they're also kind of stuck in this kind of imprisoned purgatory until they fight this battle to release them. With Aragorn in that final battle, and I thought it was a really interesting sort of parallel moment that they, the Numenoreans broke that ban, whereas the men of the Haunted Mountain they broke their oath with Isildur. I thought that was kind of interesting.
I agree. I think that's really neat. I've never thought about those two together before, but once you mention it, it does make a lot of sense. As you say, they're not exactly the same. The oath breaking is clearly very different from the rebellion of the Numenoreans in some ways, but I agree, that sense of suspended animation. Of course, the chief difference, I would say, is the fulfillment, right? There is still this, once they, the Oathbreakers, that is, once they fulfill their oath, they can have peace. Whereas the Numenoreans, it's not at all clear that they're gonna ever really get peace, because they, in some sense, have actually exiled themselves from peace by the choice that they made to rebel in the first place, and more, the choice that they made not to be content with their lot. If you make your choice not to be content with your lot, you're not gonna have peace at all. But I agree. I think that connection is a really fascinating one. And I'd have to think about that more. But no, that's very cool. Chris?
It's a strange thought. It talks about them being imprisoned until the last battle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the last battle comes, and all of a sudden there's this enormous Numenorean army that presumably is released. I think somebody asked this in the document. Whose side do they fight on? Do they redeem themselves by fighting on the side of the Valar and the good guys? Or are they so ticked off from having been imprisoned for millennia or ages and ages, they go over to the dark side? So it's just kind of an interesting thought about what mindset are they going to be in when they wake up.
Yep, I agree. If I had to guess, I would say they're going to be given a choice as to which side they're going to fight on. And if they make the right choice, it would be an opportunity for them to redeem their choice, to redeem their mistake.
And it'd be very handy to have that big army sitting there waiting to fight, too, all armed and ready to go.
Yeah, sure would. Sure would. But, if I had to guess which one they are going to choose, I don't, I don't, I don't think they're going to make the right choice. I'm not hopeful, honestly. I don't have very sanguine really expectations of the Numenoreans in the last battle there. But, you know, that's just my guess. I might be wrong. But we do know that there is a certain amount of redemption that is going to go on in the final battle. Most notably, and I think, did I mention this when we did the Turin Turambar story, the redemption of Turin in the last battle? Did we talk about that? Does this make any sense to anybody? Does anyone have any idea what I'm talking about? This was only in some of...
I remember reading something.
Yeah, yeah. This was in Tolkien's early stuff.
Turin was going to be a leader at the end.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. In fact, he's going to be in the 1930 sketch of the mythology. This is the first sort of the first wave of Tolkien's Silmarillion revisions post Lost Tales era. So he's writing the Lost Tales, and then he puts it aside for a while, and then he comes back to it. And when he comes back to it, he does a summary, which ends up being a pretty expanded summary, in which he is working through a bunch of ideas and changing some things. And in that summary, he describes the last battle. He gets to the last battle at the end, and in the last battle, Turin Turambar is going to come back, and he's the one who kills Morgoth. He kills Morgoth with his black sword. And, you know, so he is the one who will, in the end, strike the final blow against Morgoth to end evil forever. So, as I said, we know that there are, you know, that there at least were times in Tolkien's life and thought on these subjects in which he was thinking in some kind of redemptive terms about the last battle. So certainly I think that that's possible. Jordan, I rather agree with you. I think the Numenoreans can but won't redeem themselves. But of course, that is all guesswork and speculation. But I do agree that it is interestingly ambiguous. They're waiting until the last battle and the Day of Doom, which are the Day of Doom. That means Judgment Day. I mean, that's like literally what that.
Well, I think especially if you look at like. Assuming that Morgoth comes out of the void for the last battle, then the person that Sauron has promised them is the Master of Dark actually shows up, and, I mean, I think we can rightly assume that they're going to be fighting on his side.
Yep. Now, I have to admit, it was a long time. I mean, I read this book many times before I even considered the possibility that they'd be fighting for anybody but Morgoth. I mean, I was always assuming that that was the case, and I still think that that's the likeliest, case. But, good. Well, let's just, we're moving towards the end here. I just want a couple things on the closing things, the fall of anything else we wanted to add about Sauron's fall, the changing of the names, the brief references that we have to what the Dúnedain get up to in Middle-earth. We'll have plenty of time to talk about that more next week, of course. The ending of the Akalabeth. Thoughts on these last things? I think the ending of this story is kind of interesting. There's the resisting, you know, we end with the loose ends, right? Elendil and Sauron. You know, the story of Numenor as a whole is sort of finished, but those are the two loose ends from the story of Numenor. And then so on 280, he mentions both of them, but then comes back on the top of 281, but these things come not into the tale of the drowning of Numenor, of which now is all told. Elizabeth.
Yeah, I have a question that I've always wondered about, and it's just kind of a basic pragmatic question, but they have 9 ships, and you have to presume that they're not huge ships and that there aren't very many women on them. And they talk a lot about how pure the Numenorean blood is. So how exactly do they repopulate Middle-earth and end up with all of the people that they apparently have at the Last Alliance, which we are led to believe is huge? I've never understood where all of those people come from.
Right, and doesn't take place very long from now either. I mean, it's we're not talking about centuries before the Battle of the West Alliance happens. No, I'm glad you asked that. I was really puzzled by that for a long time. I remember being very confused by this. On the one hand, being told of the establishment of the kingdom. I mean, when you read it in Appendix A of The Lord of the Rings, you know, in The Return of the King, you get the sense of like them landing and establishing these wide kingdoms and everything. And I remember thinking that exact same thing, being like, first of all, so what, nine boatloads of guys establish two kingdoms stretched over hundreds and hundreds of miles? How are they building cities? How are they building that? I mean, okay, what's going on here? The answer, though, is fairly simple, and that is, it's not just the nine guys. Remember, we've been told that the faithful for a while have been fleeing Numenor and going to Middle-earth, and that there are havens of the faithful that have been already there. So there's already actually a whole bunch of Numenoreans and Numenorean descendants, probably now already like second and third generation Numenoreans, who are still of Numenorean descent and from Numenorean parentage, but have been born and raised in Middle-earth. They're already over there. Elendil and Isildur and Anarion are like the last wave coming in. And when they come in, they are the rulers. They take over. They are acknowledged because Elendil is now the last heir of Elros, surviving, not in the kingly line, of course, as we know, but a direct descendant. So I do think that there is... He gives an explanation for that, which is I think in the end pretty satisfying. But yeah, there are more people, and presumably women folk too. So we don't have a problem establishing pretty quickly some pretty wide and apparently powerful kingdoms right away.
When we see the ships come back, should we be thinking of the nine rings? I mean, that, like, they're literally sending back nine ships to fight against the nine rings that Sauron still has, the nine men that, like, that the nine evil men. Are they the nine good men that are coming back to fight? I mean, obviously it's nine ships and not nine men, but, I mean, should we be thinking of...
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know if that... The text doesn't seem to me to really insist on that parallel. I mean, I agree, the number nine does kind of jump out in that way, and especially since we know that, you know, Sauron is going to be their main target when they get back, and he's got his, you know, his nine ringwraiths. That certainly, that parallel does kind of suggest itself, but I don't really see it that way. I mean, like, for instance, the way that the Fellowship of the Ring, the nine members of the Fellowship, you know, the nine walkers are to, you know, to be set against the nine riders who are evil. I don't see that kind of parallelism there, that kind of, you know, and this is the response to Sauron, mostly because the Rings of Power are kind of irrelevant to the Numenor story. It's not even obvious that Elendil really knows or particularly cares much about the Rings of Power. Sauron doesn't have his ring with him in Numenor. He's left it behind in Mordor. We're told when he returns to Mordor that he takes up again his ring, which apparently he kept locked somewhere very, very secure in the Dark Tower. But yeah, he's the rings themselves have not yet really worked their way into prominently a central role in the story of Elendil and the Numenoreans. It's going to now, of course, and this is actually one of the things that I think makes Isildur an interesting mark for the ring, because he's not really thinking about it. This is not, the war isn't about the ring to them. The war is just about defeating Sauron. The War of the Ring, as it is called in the Lord of the Rings, is a completely ring-centric phenomenon. I mean, everybody's focused on the ring because they know this is the only chance that they have to defeat Sauron. That wasn't the case in the first time around. That is in the War of the Last Alliance. They planned to, and in fact did, take him down at full strength in person while he's wielding the Ring of Power. So it wasn't about the ring with them. And so, I mean, these are the reasons that kind of disincline me to make that kind of an explicit connection there. But But yeah, Chris, I agree with the comment that you just made in the text there. 9 is just one of those mystic numbers that recur. I mean, 9 is clearly a powerful number and an important number. I guess you could say, in a sense, it's connected to the 9 walk, to the 9 riders on a higher level. That is, there are 9 ships and 9 ringwraiths in some sense for the same reason, but not because they're connected to each other, but just because they're both the number 9, which is clearly important. Well, I mean, 9, 3, and 7 are clearly
important. Maybe it's like, you know, the elves, they have 7, and they're always in 7s, and, you know, like the stars are in 7s, and everything that they do are in 7s, and that the 9 are like men, and men are focused on the number 9 for whatever reason. That seems to be their repeating numbers.
Yeah, well, though, of course, you know, in the Rings of Power, then the elves get 3. But I mean, I agree. So there certainly are a whole bunch of 7s that do pop up with the elves. But then again, you got the 3 Silmarils, too. You know, I don't know. I mean, 7, 3, and 9 are all pretty prominent. We don't get that many 9s among the elves that I can think of. I'm thinking. I can't think of any 9s. Associated with elves explicitly. Any prominent ones? I'm probably blanking on some. But anyway, I mean, I'm hesitant to assign any sort of that specific of a meaning to it, mostly because I don't see the pattern that clearly. Because there clearly are 7s that are important, to the men. Cause you're right, Jordan, there were 7, Palantir, and the symbol of the House of Elendil is the 7 stars too. So 7s are clearly associated with the humans, as you know, 7s, as you say, are frequently associated with the elves. But 3 is also associated with the elves a lot, and 7 gets associated with the dwarves as well. So I mean, it's a little too all over the place for me to really kind of put my finger on it, but it's pretty clear that those numbers are themselves important and interesting. Treebeard has 7 toes, you know, I mean, it's all really important. What did you think about the names? We have the changing of the names. We spent some time looking at the names that Numenor is given at the beginning, right? We get, of course, a whole list of names. It's not enough just to say that it was called Numenore. We're also told, you know, all the other things that it's called, right? Andor, the land of gift, right?
I remember the first time I read this, and when I got to the Adelone at the very end, I was so excited for no particular reason that it had this bizarre parallel that I actually knew and didn't realize until the very, very end of it.
Yes, yes. When the Atalanta is pulled out of the hat, as well, as you say, in the next paragraph, the Avalone, when all of a sudden we get these explicit through names connections to Avalon and Atlantis, it's pretty cool. I always think that that's a really fun. That's always a really fun moment in class. I love it when we get here in my undergrad survey, because a bunch of the time, usually the majority of the class kind of skips over it, because you can always tell who has gotten kind of inoculated against names. And so when they come to a list of names, they just start skimming. And so I'll go back and draw their attention to those particular names. And it's always a really cool moment, because the students in the car is like, oh, it's a fun light bulb moment there. Laura?
Well, this is kind of a different thing than you were talking about, but at the very end, at least in my edition, which is the illustrated edition, there's 3 paragraphs that are indented differently than the rest of the tale here. So, why is that? Do you know? Or are all the editions indented, or is it just mine, or is that just a printing thing?
No, that is pretty standard for that passage. The typographical implication here is that the story has ended, the primary text has ended, with the names. Akalabeth the Downfallen, Atalanta in the Eldarin tongue, the end. Now, Colophon, we have a little extra business here, a little extra add-on, like something somebody has written in by hand, as a scribal note or something at the end. That's pretty consistent. You'll remember there was a similar thing at the end of the Quintus Silmarillion. If you go back to the very end of the Voyage of Eärendil, we get that, you know, here ends the Silmarillion. If it has passed from the high and the beautiful to darkness and ruin, that was of old the fate of Ardamard. That whole passage is indented in the same kind of way. So I think, especially thinking back to the discussion we were having at the very beginning about the source and the provenance of this theoretically historical text that we're getting. These are like, not exactly annotations, because it's not annotating the stuff that came before, but these sort of additions. It's like a little postscript. I think that's pretty consistent. What do you make of that last section?
Yeah, I have a first edition, and I looked at it, and it's indented in the first edition as well, so it seems to be consistent throughout all the print.
Yeah. Jordan with his awesome first edition. Good. Mike?
I really loved this final three paragraphs. I found it lyrical, just beautiful, and then almost approaching kind of a dreamlike quality, and at the same time sort of conveying to the reader that this blessed realm is still accessible, and reader, it could happen to you. Like, this could all, this straight road is still there, and just very strange and beautiful and evocative, and the fact that it ends with that image of a single forlorn sailor on the verge of death dropping away from the earth and then coming upon the blessed realm. It's just amazing, and it ends the tale in a sort of beautiful way, in some ways a slightly intimidating and spooky way. All of these things sort of mixed together, but I'm glad that it's there.
I think the effect of this as the ending of this story is really striking and really powerful. The very ending of it always really hit, like those last three words always really hit me. If you look back, this is another, Mike, another one of these really long sentences. And tales and rumors arose along the shores of the sea concerning mariners and men forlorn upon the water, who, by some fate or grace or favor of the Valar, had entered in upon the straight way, and seen the face of the world sink below them, and so had come to the lamplit quays of Avalone, or verily to the last beaches on the margin of Aman, and there had looked upon the white mountain, dreadful and beautiful, before they died. Before they died. We can't just end it with that. I mean, dreadful and beautiful. Surely that would have been enough, right? You know, we were getting beautiful, right? And the whole face of the world sinking below them sounded dreadful in the old sense. Awe-inspiring and inspiring, a kind of a numinous fear. But then before they died, right? That this is always a fatal experience. It's nice, but it's brief. Yes, Jordan, as you say, this is Bilbo and Frodo are dead. Yes, exactly. That does emphasize that. I think that it's that, and that's the final note. You know, that even this straight road, it still exists. And it is possible sometimes by some fate or grace or favor of the Valar, all those oars, we don't know exactly why it happens. It could be for any of these reasons. But this is not just a blessing. It is a blessing, but it's not just a blessing. The door, the way, is still shut. Elizabeth, now that you've gotten me thinking about the Oathbreakers, now I'm thinking about the Paths of the Dead, and poor Brego, who dies trying to fulfill his oath to walk the Paths of the Dead. The way is shut, and even those who are permitted in don't really make it, and they don't find immortality by any sense. In fact, quite the contrary. Laura?
Yeah, I was just going to say, by some favor of the Valar, well, it doesn't seem like a big favor since, you know, it kills them, basically, too.
Beats drowning, though.
So, well, that's true. At least you get to see some really cool stuff before you go.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, I mean, I wonder, are these just sailors going along and all of a sudden they just happen to hit the straight path? Or is it the Valar saying, "Oh, you know, let's let these guys in. What the heck?" And how does anyone know that if they all die before they before they get back?
Yeah, you know? No. This is another one of those "it is said" passages. You know, tales and rumors arose along the shores of the sea concerning mariners and men forlorn upon the water. Yeah, no, no one's come back to say this. We have this wonderful kind of combination where on the one hand, just earlier on in this paragraph, we're told that a logical deduction has been made. Therefore, the lore masters of men said that a straight road must still be for those that were permitted to find it. So, the wise and learned among men have drawn the rational conclusion that the straight road, they have philosophically proven the existence of the straight road. So that's sort of on the one hand, the learned conclusions, the learned and rational conclusions of the lore master. And then that is being coupled with tales and rumors arising along the shore of the sea, among mariners and people who live on the sea. So, you got both of those things, just these stories, and the lore, and the combination of those two things brings about these tales and rumors that this does happen. But that to me makes it the more fascinating. You'd think if this were just stories popping up among men, that there's this miraculous thing that does sometimes happen, that can happen, that people are transported and they find their way, they suddenly find themselves in Avalon, they suddenly find themselves in Fairy, capital F. Well, you'd think that maybe these would be good stories, right? Like that, you know, pie-in-the-sky stories of like, and then they found the land of youth and lived forever and ever and were very happy.
Well, I just thought of something. It could be that some of them kind of stumbled their way home and then just told their story and just died.
And then died.
It doesn't say exactly when they died.
Right.
You know.
Right. Doesn't say they died instantly. I don't know.
It doesn't say died instantly, so maybe some of them were able to get back and, you know, in very dramatic fashion, sort of hoarsely whisper their story on the beach before they pass away.
Why does this, for some reason, make me think of, you know, the castle of but anyway, perhaps that's just me. I don't know. Mike?
I just wanted to mention that I think Tolkien mentioned that one of his goals was to undo the kind of Victorian sentiment of, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we could visit where the fairies live? And, you know, there's plenty of places to point to where you can say, okay, you know, mission accomplished. Having read this, you know, I will not fall into that Victorian fantasy ever again.
Right.
And so I think this is one of those times. And then the other thing I like is that I like the fact that there's no easy way to get to the straight road. It's not pinpointed, like you said, in other stories in these kind of genres. Sometimes you have the statement, you know, if you're young at heart, or if you do this or do that, or, you know, or you can make it, but not in this story, and not in the way that this mythology is created. And I prefer it that way.
Yeah, yeah. Both of those things are great points. This is not, it is clearly not a reward for action, at least not consistently a reward. But it is, and not that it's random either. I mean, great fate is one of the things mentioned as well, you know, one of the explanations of it. But yeah, no, I think that this is, and your first point is I think a really important one. This, in my mind, is one of the passages I would point to. You know, if somebody wanted to say, well, like, you know, okay, I've heard, you know, people say that one of the things that Tolkien was trying to do in his mythological stories is to, kind of correct some of the misunderstandings, some of the ideas about fairies and about fairy that had grown up in the generation or two before him, or actually the several hundred years before him. Of course, I would point them to many of the things that he says in his essay on fairy stories, but, you know, this is another passage that I think would be great to send them to, Mike, for exactly the reasons that you said. Wouldn't it be great to go to fairy? No, it would be a very, very serious thing, but at the same time, it's not like the wonder and the desire of it is not there, right? I mean, there is still a sense, even these guys, these lost sailors who are being killed by the sight of the White Mountain, this is still grace or favor of the Valar. This is still a good thing. This is still a blessing that they're getting. That they come verily to the last beaches on the margin of Aman. There's still wonder there. There's still desire there. And looked upon the White Mountain, dreadful and beautiful, before they died. It still sounds like a good thing, but not at all the simple good thing of like, hey, like, what's good in Never Never Land? I think that this is a really sublime, as you say. I think clearly there is definitely sublimity to it. But it is so sublime that it's actually fatal, but that's kind of a good thing. I think makes this such a fascinating conclusion to the Akalabeth story. Remember that one of the primary things at stake, the beef between the Numenoreans and the elves specifically, that is not just their not just their rebellion against Iluvatar, and not just their grumbling against the Valar, but against the elves in particular, was how they kept saying, hey, aren't we too among the mighty of Arda, right? Like, we're just as good as you. We're just kind of like, we have at least as much stature as you do. In a fair fight, we might be able to take you, right? I mean, that's ultimately what they're going to prove there at the end. But I think that here we can see this distance between the Eldar and men really asserted. No, it's not the same. You couldn't handle fairy. But that doesn't mean it wouldn't be a blessing to be taken there. And so you get both sides of that asserted. But again, that gap, that distance, just like Iluvatar bending the earth and making the ban of the Valar permanent, irrevocable, and almost absolute, we see again the gulf, literally, between men and elves being asserted here at the end. And there isn't any more of this, hey, we're the same and we're all, we're just, we're alike and on the same terms, you and I, elves and men. So I think that that's therefore a very relevant note to be striking at the end of the Akalabeth. Okay, we did it. We finished the Akalabeth, and next week we will go into Rings of Power in the Third Age. I know that some of you want to do a lot of comparison. I know particularly I briefly saw earlier on Dave and Jordan conspiring to prolong our discussion of these, 20 pages almost indefinitely. I really don't want to do that. We're not actually doing our survey of the Lord of the Rings yet. As I've said before, I do plan to do a Lord of the Rings seminar. I want to go through the Lord of the Rings in great detail, but that is not yet. That is not what is going to be starting next week. What I particularly want to be looking at when we go to Of the Rings of Power in the Third Age is especially how this fits into the Silmarillion context. We're going to be given some background and then a very short summary of the Lord of the Rings here. But clearly this is all being told in the context of the last stage of this story that we've been reading about. We get a long section on the first age, and then we get a short chapter on the second age and a short chapter on the third age. How does it fit? In what sense, how does seeing this larger context from the First Age perspective help us to understand or contextualize the events of the Third Age, which we've already gotten in lots of detail in the Lord of the Rings. So that's where we're going to that's where we're going to head with that. So thanks everybody for joining us again, and I look forward to our discussion next week.
And that ends the last session on the Alcala Baith. There's more to come, though, so look for the next episode. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.